From World War to Class War, The Rebound of the Rich. You're listening to Longwood's Radio, your healthcare source for ideas, new policies, and best practices. The distribution of income in Canada, as in many other countries, is becoming increasingly unequal. This is not exactly late-breaking news, though the issue seems to have stayed largely below the public radar. Several recent papers, however, have focused in particular on the highest incomes and placed this trend in historical context. Forward to the past. Income in North America is now concentrated in the hands of the very, very wealthy, to a degree not seen since before the Second World War. And with greater wealth comes greater political influence. Public policy, including health policy, is increasingly driven by the priorities of the wealthy, overriding the concerns of the general population. Piketty and Shays examine the concentration of income in the United States over most of the last century, with comparative data for Canada and several other countries. Between 1919 and 1940, the top 10% of American earners accounted for relatively steady 43%, 46% of total incomes. The onset of war, however, brought major increases in corporate taxes and steeply progressive individual taxation. Top earners' share plummeted to about one-third and stayed there for the next 40 years. In that era, studying income distribution was likened to watching paint dry or grass grow. Then came the 1980s and, coincidentally, the elections of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Money began to flow back to the long end. Today, the pre-war relationship has largely been re-established. The higher, the better. Times are very good in the top decile, but the more thinly one top slices income distribution, the better they get. The top 1% saw their share increase from 8% to 17%, but the gains still farther up are even more extraordinary. The highest earning 10,000th, representing about 30,000 people, increased their share from 0.5% to nearly 3% of all incomes earned in the United States. 2.5 percentage points may not seem like much, but it was enough to raise these people's relative incomes by a factor of 6, from about 50 times the national average to about 300 times. Canada and the United Kingdom have followed the U.S. pattern. Their trends are, as usual, less extreme than in the United States, but over 20 years at the top 1,000th of Canadian earners have more than doubled their share, and the top 0.01%, representing about 3,300 people, saw their share rise from 0.5% to 1.8%. Yet in France and Japan, the pattern is totally different and seems to refute any explanation based on universal economic laws at work in the development of advanced industrial economies. One might want to focus instead on country-specific institutions and policies. Dr. Pangloss, right on cue. Nevertheless, a common response by economists to increasing economic inequity has been to look for general external factors unrelated to particular institutions or policies. The favorite code phrase is skill-biased technological progress. Continuing technological innovation makes possible ever-increasing productivity and correspondingly ever-increasing incomes, the holy grail of growth. But it just happens. It's no one's choice or fault, just part of the structure of the universe that, at present, technical progress is increasing the demand for, and thus the relative incomes of, the highly educated and highly skilled. Incomes are more unequal because, given present technology, individual productivity is more unequal. What could be more fairer than that? So economic growth, which is very good and very important, comes with the side effect of increasing economic inequity, which some people may think is not so good. But it would be very wrong-headed for governments to interfere with the allocation of incomes by the impersonal forces of the market. Imposing more progressive taxation, for example, or expanding income support programs or the provision of public services or even raising minimum wages or facilitating unionization would risk lowering the rate of economic growth and thus would be really bad. Such policies would condemn a society to progressively declining incomes compared with more economically enlightened countries. Policy should rather seek to minimize public interventions, regardless of the distributional consequences, in order to encourage even more rapid growth. If increasing inequality is a concern, the proper response is for those losing ground to get more training. Send the children to the Harvard Business School, or even enroll yourself. The corporate kleptocrats. Not such a bad idea at that, but don't expect any public support. Paralleling the march of inequity across North America has been an extraordinary increase in the compensation of corporate senior executives, and particularly of CEOs. Friedman presents the results of a long-term study of a sample of major American corporations with the substantial Canadian operations. Her focus is on testing various economic explanations for this recent increase, but the basic data are interesting enough. Over the decade of the 1970s, the median total annual compensation was $1.03 million USD in 2000. This was a slow and unremarkable rise from $890,000 in the period of 1936 to 1939. But then median executive earnings took off, $1.53 million in the 1980s, $2.9 million in the 1990s, and $5.23 million in the 2000 to 2003. The spread of the corporate ranks also widened dramatically. Average total compensation among the 90th percentile of corporate executives rose from $2.06 million in the 1970s to $22.19 million in the years 2000 to 2003. Top earnings rose more than 9% per year, compounded over 27 years. The rest of the American labor force fared somewhat less well. The ratio of CEO compensation to average production workers' pay, which had averaged 42 to 1 in 1982, was 10 times higher, 431 to 1 in 2004. These are staggering increases. They correspond to an intriguing observation by Piketty and Shays. The pre-war period was still the era of the rentier. The super-rich were sustained primarily by income from investments, but the dramatic resurgence after 1980 was powered by increases in salaries and business earnings, including those of corporate executives. It appears that in the current era, those at the top have found alternative ways of extracting and concentrating wealth from the corporate sector. But this would imply conscious agency, inconsistent with conventional economic thinking. A more economistical approach interprets CEO earnings as just another manifestation of skill bias. In this case, skill-biased environmental change. The corporate world has become dramatically more complex and competitive. What with globalization and the internet and all that, such that the value to the corporation's shareholders at the very top, best top management, the superstars, has greatly increased. But where are all the superstars now? The argument rests on faith in the collective intelligence and ability of corporate directors in matching rewards with contributions. Empirical support for this is distinctly dubious. The CEO who took more corporation shares from $16 to $3, for example, picked up $40 million on his way out the door. And then there's John Roth. Economic faith insists, nonetheless, that on average, CEOs must be worth the money or rational, fully informed boards of directors, wholly dedicated to the enhancement of shareholder value, would not offer such whacking great compensation packages. The existence of these idealized boards has been vigorously challenged by Bebchuk and Fried. We show that under legal arrangements, boards cannot be expected to contract at arm's length with the executives whose pay they set. Faith or no, however, there is in fact no logical link from the argument that exceptional managerial talent confers a corresponding competitive advantage on the corporation, and the conclusion that a general growth in executive compensation will raise the overall productivity of a society. Nor, more generally, does economic theory provide any priori basis for the proposition that greater inequality is associated with greater economic efficiency. The equality-efficiency trade-off, popularized by Arthur Okun, was simply a theoretical blunder, taken up enthusiastically in pop economics, presumably because of its political attractiveness. The relationship between inequality and growth is thus an empirical one, and as usual, the empirical studies are mixed. It depends upon when and where and what else is going on. For what it's worth, we do find that the rate of growth of real national income per head in the English-speaking countries is substantially higher than in France or Japan, at least over the 10 and 5-year periods prior to 2003. But it isn't worth very much. So where did all the productivity go? The apparently central issue of inequality and growth turns to be irrelevant, a red herring. For most of us in North America, there hasn't been much growth. The gains have been captured all at the top end. Between 1976 and 1990, average personal income per capita in Canada rose only 0.6% per year. From 1990 to 2000, it didn't grow at all. Similar patterns emerged in the United States. We show that over the entire period of 1966 to 2001, as well as over 1997 to 2001, median real wage and salary income barely grew at all, because half of the income gains went to the top 10% of the income distribution. The corporate kleptocrats are making out like bandits, but none of this wealth is trickling down. So even if public policies to mitigate inequality were to threaten the aggregate rate of growth, what have most of us got to lose? These are heretical thoughts, totally out of sync with the economic zeitgeist. The public agenda has for a number of years been prodded in the opposite direction. Smaller government, tax cuts, privatization, deregulation, and ever greater scope for free markets. But who or what is calling forth these geists? Surveys suggest that at least in Canada there are not the priorities of the general public, only of the elites, and no wonder. The contrast of priorities was nicely illustrated by Conrad Black's vitriolic editorial after the federal election of 2000. Canadian governments are engaged in a process of taking money from people who have earned it and redistributing it to people who haven't, more or less in exchange for their votes. Lord Black's concept of earned may be somewhat idiosyncratic. He is currently under indictment in the United States for fraud and racketeering. But if we strike that word, he is correct. Governments in every country are primarily and pretty much the only institutions for redistributing income and in-kind benefits down the income spectrum. If voters support that, well, isn't that how democracies are supposed to work? Starving the welfare state. The counter-strategy for the wealthy is simple enough. Cripple the fiscal capacity of governments through tax cuts, particularly for themselves. After all, if you are stinking rich, you don't need much of a government. The welfare state wastes money on all sorts of public services you either do not need or are perfectly capable of buying privately. And to add insult, governments are often interfere with your enterprises in the name of some exiguous public interest. A watchman state is quite sufficient. This agenda is well advanced in the United States. The tax cuts under the Bush administration have created a federal debt that will hobble government for years or decades, and the beneficiaries have indeed been wealthy. The New York Times reports that in 2003, cuts to taxes on investment income transferred an average of $500,000 each to those with incomes over $10 million, bringing their average gains from combined Bush tax cuts to just over $1 million. Of the total revenue forgone, 42% went to those with incomes of over $1 million, 0.1% of all taxpayers. Canada is very different, so far. The federal government has been running surpluses for years and is very slowly reducing the federal debt. But the same pressures are at work. The Alberta flat tax and Senator Kirby's proposed income-linked health care premiums both significantly lower the tax burdens of the highest earners, as did the BC tax cuts of 2001. The subsequent program cuts required to restore budget balance have been mostly wealthy-friendly. Meanwhile, since the mid-1990s, the federal and provincial governments have between them foregone through tax cuts a sum now not unadjacent to $60 million a year. Accumulated over the last decade, these amounts could have made a very big hole in the public debt. The recent proposals from the Canadian Council of Chief Executives are the most transparent attack on the public sector. Downloading a much greater share of taxation and of responsibility for public programs from the federal to the provincial level is designed to trigger a classic race to the bottom. Provincial governments would be under increased pressure to compete more aggressively in cutting taxes and public spending. The casualties would certainly include the Canada Health Act and Medicare, and probably much of the public support for post-secondary education. Advocates of this program, including the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, emphasize the importance of international competitiveness and faster economic growth. The New York Times report quotes a lobbyist to the effect that investment earnings should not be taxed at all, because they will be saved and invested, creating more jobs and faster growth. On this logic, government should perhaps introduce a negative tax for investment earnings. The new capital investments and the income they generate would, of course, all be owned by the same thin top slice of the income distribution who received the tax breaks in the first place. As every economist knows, however, government surpluses are an alternative and equally effective form of national savings. They flow directly into the bond market as government debt is repaid, and are there available to private investors. But the ownership of this form of savings and investment is not concentrated among the very wealthy, so no one lobbies for bigger surpluses. Indeed, the public commentary in Canada seems quite negative. Better, apparently, to promote growth through corporate tax cuts for the wealthy. Curious. Money, myths, and medicine. But what has all this got to do with healthcare policy? The connection, I suggest, is that the attack on the welfare state and the erosion of post-war consensus on the role of government parallels the dramatic increase of the concentration of wealth. The public systems of healthcare are a centerpiece of the welfare state. They are a natural focus for attack on the Willie Sutton principle. That's where the money is. And smaller government requires a larger role for private finance. Public healthcare also offers, at least outside the United States, less scope for the corporate kleptocracy. It is also by far the most widely used and strongly supported of any public service. To discredit government, you must discredit public healthcare. And you must discredit government, as the Dark Lord clearly recognized, if you are to reduce its depredations on the wealth of the upper classes. When he brought the Southern Chain and founded the National Post, Black was quite open about his intent to use them as a propaganda vehicle to shift the center of gravity of public debate in Canada. Whatever his personal fate, he appears to have succeeded. The torch has now been picked up by the Aspers and Canwest Global. Meanwhile, a string of think tanks has emerged on the model of the highly successful Fraser Institute, privately and well-financed, to serve as a propaganda outlets for the corporate sector and to undermine confidence in governments. As always, the original models are American. It works. Behind the notorious Chiloui decision, for example, lie at least 15 years of anti-Medicare disinformation seeping into the ill-informed and inadequately critical minds of the majority court. Erroneous and often patently absurd claims about healthcare and the public-private mix have been around in more or less the same form for many decades. They have their roots in the simple fact that public healthcare systems transferred both resources and access down to the income spectrum from the wealthy and healthy to the unhealthy and unwealthy. Public financing can also limit the transfer of wealth from those who pay for care to those who are paid for it. These effects are ever-fertile sources of well-worn and spacious arguments as to why such transfers limitations are unfair, inefficient, and unhealthy. But why have these myths been promulgated with increasing energy over the last quarter century, becoming embedded like coproliths in the media and in political debate? They are no less specious, but the political landscape has changed dramatically. Medicare is now very much on the defense. The spectacular growth in the incomes of the super-rich, expanding the resources behind their agenda, may it offer at least part of the explanation. If we are back to a pre-war income distribution, how much of our post-war social policies can survive? Robert G. Evans is the professor of economics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC. This has been Longwoods Radio. Thanks for listening.